want to get rid of every time?
No.
Then they won't.
We're going to call a meeting to order. This is State Government Finance for Tuesday, February 22nd, 2011. We're still a couple short of a quorum, and so we're going to go ahead and get started. We'll do the minutes later in the meeting. Our first presentation is from the Public Facilities Authority. We have Mr. Coleman and Mr. Freeman. Welcome. And please identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Terry Kuhlman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority.
And I'm Jeff Freeman, Deputy Director of the Public Facilities Authority.
Yeah. We've tried to meet with quite a few of the members this past week, but we provided the committee members with kind of a book, a little summary of what we are and things we do. And a lot of information in that packet, and I'll start and give a brief overview, and then I'll have Jeff kind of explain what's all in the book. But the PFA is kind of a unique agency in state government in that we're governed by six different state agency commissioners from representing MMB, DEED, Department of Agriculture, PCA, Department of Health, and Department of Transportation. And we specialize more or less in the municipal finance arena and finance public infrastructure that's really critical not only for the economic well-being of the state but the environmental as well. We manage several funds. I think our key role is really three revolving funds at state level. By far the biggest is Clean Water, which finances stormwater and municipal wastewater. We also provide money to both Department of Agriculture and the Pollution Control Agency to address non-point source pollution projects. We have, in essence, our role in making loans. We look at the project priority list that the agencies provide in the clean water and wastewater, and we use that priority list and projects that are ready to go and look at them. Our staff look at the ability and affordability of those communities to repay the loan, and if additional grant assistance is needed or they're eligible for grant programs, staff work with communities to get those grant funds available. Statutorily, we have $1.5 billion worth of bonding authority. We're at about $1.1 billion. I guess March 1st will be down to 1.1 after we pay our bonds off that mature this year. Those are revenue bonds separate from the state general obligation bonds. They're solely backed by the revenues generated by the authority, primarily from the loans that we've made and interest earnings on debt service reserve funds. The PFA is relatively small. We have 10 FTEs, or 10 staff, I shouldn't say FTEs, 10 full-time staff, including myself, and we work real closely with other agencies. We rely on both Department of Health and PCA to do plan and spec review, do the environmental reviews, and other compliance-related activities. To approve projects prior to bidding, and once projects are bid, we generally will make the contract award. Unlike most other state agencies, they provide contracts up front. We do not do that until we actually know what the cost, as-bid cost of projects are. So we're a little strange, or a little different in that regard. There are two org charts. Right behind that first page in the book, the first one is kind of an org chart based on the programs. You'll see the clean water on the left, the two programs I mentioned, the Ag BMP program, which provides funding to mostly farmers and rural residents for septics, but farmers for feedlots and conservation tillage equipment and riparian strips to avoid or to reduce water pollution. PCA has a clean water partnership, which is funded in part by us, also a little some funding from the federal government to do diagnostic studies, and also the Clean Water Fund, the dedicated sales tax goes into that. Then we kind of break down the roles. On the far right side is the drinking water program and also the transportation revolving loan fund. Transportation is a relatively small program. We do only do a couple projects a year as loans are repaid. It was set up at the federal level a little over a decade ago with some seed money to try to look at innovative ways of financing transportation projects, not using traditional sources of funds, basically gas tax. And the next page is the org chart, basically as it lays out the staff positions. And we are going to be losing one of our senior loan officers. Took a position to manage the small business centers around the state in Deed. So we'll be hiring to replace that position, so hopefully in the near future. And that kind of, we also have contracts with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. They have hired a bond counsel locally, although he's not providing legal services. He's Joe Ganella. At the advice of the Attorney General's office, we contract and share services with Joe, because he's just a dynamite, real sharp guy, and helps us a lot when we're issuing bonds, compliance issues and disclosure issues and proofreading and stuff like that. So it, from a cost perspective, he's a lot cheaper than hiring a bond counsel, even though we do have bond counsel as well. So we do have a lot of interagency agreements. We also provide administrative costs to the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health to cover their work on approving and reviewing projects for us to consider the financing for. So they basically look at plans and specs and review, make sure they will actually meet the desired results, and they certify those projects over to us for funding. So that's kind of a real brief overview of what we do. Our sources of funding, to be real honest, we have very little bit of general fund money, $86,000, which all goes to grants to very small communities. I'm talking 15 to 30 households to hire a septic designer to look at septic replacement when they've been identified as having failing septics and causing water pollution one sort or another. We also rely on the Clean Water Fund or Clean Water Legacy, often referred to the dedicated sales tax, for some grant programs dealing with total daily maximum load requirements that municipalities have to go through. We seek funding in the bonding bill for our state match. We get federal funds on an annual basis. It's varied from $12.5 million a year on up to $37 million a year. ERA, I think that we got an additional $104 million under the Economic Recovery Funds Act a couple years ago. That did not require a state match, but otherwise the federal funds all require $1 for every $5 of federal money. And historically we've gotten the state match for the federal funds through the bonding bill. And we also have a wastewater infrastructure funding program, which is kind of a gap financing program for high-cost projects. When they sewer rates exceed 1.4% of median household income, looking at operation maintenance and debt service, the state, the PFA, provides 80% of the cost over and above that, try to keep sewer rates down. We also partner with USDA Rural Development, which deals with the very small communities, mostly under 500 population, in the state, and there are a lot of those. And when they determine a city needs is eligible for grant, we match the, we provide 65% of the grant need, they provide 35% of the grant need plus loan, and then they manage the project. So our interaction with municipalities is pretty much limited to depositing money after rural development reviews the expenses on a monthly basis and request money. So the city can pay the contractors. So it's a good partnership we have with them. And we do that so we can capture those federal dollars. They were starting to send back money to Washington because they were unable to use all their loan funds. And we also like using their staff to work with the very small communities because they're more labor intensive to work with, and they have probably three times the staff we do out in the field to work with those communities. So it's a good partnership. Did I miss anything, Jeff?
Well,
but anyway, I'll turn it over to Jeff, and he'll briefly run through the rest of the book.
Mr. Freeman?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just briefly explain what's in your packet. I won't go into any detail, but the tabs in the packet identify our major program areas. Behind the clean water programs tab, you'll see on the first page identifies the base programs, the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which is the revolving loan program that Terry talked about, and then the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, the WIF program, which provides the supplemental grants for the based on affordability criteria. On the back side of that page lists the three programs that have been funded under the Dedicated Clean Water Fund, basically grants to help cities that are being required to go over and above, provide additional treatment beyond what they would otherwise have to do in order to address impaired waters and other water quality concerns. There's a list there of the projects that we funded under the clean water, all the different clean water programs for fiscal year 2010. You'll see many of the projects were split funded through a variety of programs and we do package funds both within the programs that we manage and then, as Terry mentioned, also with USDA Rural Development and some of the other funders. There's a few sheets that give more detail on loans that have been made and the sources and uses of the revolving fund, some charts that identify the kind of the leveraging that we get from the state and federal dollars and the loans that versus the loans that we make each year, and projected future capacity of the fund. And then you get to the green sheets, which is the PCA's project priority list in priority order. You can see the projects identified with a total cost, and then you can see the PFA financing programs broken down, the Clean Water Revolving Fund, and then WIF in kind of various categories of both what's currently awarded or reserved and projected need or estimated need. The Clean Water Fund programs, which I mentioned, come from the dedicated sales tax, and then other funders that we work with and package funding for based on what cities are eligible for and trying to help the cities put together an affordable funding package. These are really very expensive infrastructure projects for cities and really vital to get done. So there's a lot of work that goes into kind of coordinating the different funding sources and helping cities understand how the process works.
The shaded areas, by the way, are the projects that are already under contract for this year.
And this is just the fiscal year 2011 list, and if you go to the bottom, the last page, you can see there's about $2 billion worth of total needs, I guess closer to $2.1 billion. That's a need projection that is generally considered to be or a five-year need. But generally, it probably drags out a little longer than that. It's a lot of times pretty complicated to put these projects together, and so it may be more like a 5 to 8 year need. An alphabetical list, if you're looking for an individual project on the priority list, behind the drinking water tab are the same kinds of sheets and information for the drinking water program. Behind the program, the tab that says other PFA programs, there you can see a little information about the Transportation Revolving Loan Fund, and on the back side of the sheet is a list of the projects we funded through that program from the beginning. And also the Credit Enhancement Program is listed there. That's a program where there's not direct financing from the Public Facilities Authority, but under state law, we process applications for cities and counties that are selling their own bonds in the private market can apply to this program. General obligation bonds that are being sold for specific uses, cities, it's sewer, water, and stormwater. Counties, it can include law enforcement facilities, social service facilities, some other uses, correctional things. And so those entities that are selling their own bonds in the market can receive a limited state guarantee, which helps them get a better bond rating and therefore a lower interest cost. And there's a list of the counties and cities that have had their bonds back to that program. If there haven't been any defaults, if there were a default, to the extent there's money in the state general fund, the state would step in, make that and payment, that one payment that the entity couldn't make, and then we would go back and get repaid from the city or county with interest through tax levy, because these are geo-backed bonds, or some other source. There's a state aid intercept built into that program. So one way or the other, the money.
Standard & Poor's rates these credits as AAA rated, so that's why cities use this program. And Moody's gives it a AA, just one notch below their rating of the state fund. So it's worth cities.
And it does save cities quite a bit of money, or a fair amount of money on their bond sales, and doesn't really cost anything at the state level. And then finally, the last tab identifies 2011 legislative session. The first sheet there is the requests for the three PFA programs that are funded through the Clean Water Fund, the dedicated sales tax. Again, these are basically grants to cities for them to go over and above what they would otherwise have to do in terms of treatment levels in order to clean up impaired waters. And there's also, if by chance there were a bonding bill, our WIF program, which is follows, again, the priority list set by the PCA, and based on affordability criteria, cities have to be over 1.4% of median household income with their system costs for the wastewater system to trigger this, which means for most cities you've got to be about $45 to $50 a month before there's any grant funds that would kick in. But this is the list for that program, and that we would, if there was a bonding bill this year or next year, we by statute are required to do a report every other year prior to the bonding year session that lists out all of the eligible WIF, estimated WIF needs, which the list you've got in here is kind of the preliminary look at that. And with that, we'll stop and answer any questions.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and speakers, two questions. One, in the clean water section, I don't see any distinguishing of the legacy funds. Is there anything that you're doing that's using legacy funds for clean water?
Mr. Coleman, Mr. Freeman?
Yes. The legacy funds are the, if you look on the, under the clean water section, we seek state funding for the state match and the WIF program through bonding. The other three programs, the TMDL grant program, the phosphorus reduction grant program, under other PFA programs. Where is it? And also the small community wastewater treatment, which deals with small communities that have failing septic issues. All those are clean water legacy funded, and they were created in the Clean Water Legacy Act. They were designed to be funded through the dedicated funds when that constitutional amendment was passed. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, since some of us are trying to follow what's happening with that, it would be really nice if that was written out. I mean, it takes a little more insider knowledge to know to have to go back to last year's bill to see what it is.
All right.
So I think legacy funds are specific funds. They're specifically, they have specific constraints on them compared to others, and so I just like to really know when they're part of another funding, when they're doing something.
Yes, and I should
themselves.
Point out one of the things I failed, Representative Kahn and members, is the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program, where we have $86,000 base budget. We also get $2 million for that program out of the Clean Water Legacy Funding, the Clean Water Fund. And last year it was trimmed back a little bit along with everybody else. It used to be a $100,000 year base budget. But the Constitution said you cannot supplant the existing funds with those. So it's Mary can probably, Representative Murphy could probably explain those issues better than I. So they were trimmed back a little bit, but not necessarily eliminated.
Okay. Well, I would just like that pointed out. You know, maybe a note that would specifically, or just tell staff people what, put a star neck or big L or something, or a big MM for Mary Murphy, or
another thing
something.
You can look at is on the green sheet, when we list all the projects, we do include the clean water funding programs. Up on the upper right-hand column, it's the total daily, or TMDL grant program, the phosphorus reduction grant program.
Yeah, but the green sheets were difficult for those of us who didn't bring on magnifying glasses and are a little bit older. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, there's also behind the tab that says other, or 2011 legislative session, the first sheet there identifies the PFAs, the clean water legacy programs, and the funding requests for this biennium.
Where?
The last section of the book, the first page in the last section of the booklet.
Okay. I'm starting to see how I can find it. I still don't see the word legacy anywhere on that page. Oh, that. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we have the logo up on top.
Yeah, I know.
We were told we're not supposed to refer to it as a Clean Water Legacy Fund. We're supposed to call it Clean Water Fund, so we do that.
Okay, great.
That's a decision.
Okay, then, Mr. Chairman, my other question was, I'm not sure it's a good idea to point to Wisconsin for an example of anything right now, but I asked this question of Commissioner Showalter yesterday, and he kind of answered it, but I don't know if your funds are different. One of the things that Wisconsin is looking at for its budget problems is refinancing outstanding bonds. Do your bonds fall into that category of something that could that you should look at for refinancing every once in a while when interest rates change?
Yeah,
or do they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, in October, when interest rates were at their all-time low, we did refinance everything that was profitable to do so.
Okay. So you, Mr. Chairman, you do it along with the, you don't do it separately. You do it along with the management and budget.
We're a separate bond-issuing entity, no backing of the state whatsoever, and we sell revenue bonds. In October, we sold close to $400 million worth of bonds, half of it refunding, about a third refunding and the other two-thirds finance projects. And we sell bonds based on the cash flow needs of the project.
Representative Kahn?
And are there specific limits on the refinancing? I mean, I assume if interest rates go low again, is that something you could do again and that you follow and look at?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Madam Kahn. We look at that all the time if there's opportunities to save money. It's a combination of when the maturity of the outstanding individual bonds are and the interest rate at the time, and plus arbitrage issues and things like that. We saved a real good chunk of money this fall. We hit the market at the right time, sold bonds for 2.97% for 20 years. Real good rate.
Okay.
Mr. Coleman, are we finished?
Yes.
Mr. Coleman, I'm looking at page 5 of the agency profile summary from the governor's budget, and It shows a marked increase in total expenditures by fund for this current biennium, and there are a couple of footnotes that explain that, explain it partially, but can you give us more of an explanation as to what explains that sharp increase, more than doubling of total fund expenditures?
Yes.
And I realize you've got here both operational costs as well as the bonds that are sold, and it would be very helpful to have that broken out. I mean, and I don't know if you've got.
We can provide that information, but in essence, what you're seeing in the 208-209, when the Congress started talking about grant programs, economic recovery, when Obama was elected, pretty much everything just shut down. We only did a couple loans from about a six-month period. The cities were waiting, hoping to get federal grant funds. So once that came about, we had this huge, not only a backlog, but an expectation that a lot of cities were hoping to get 100% grant funding. Like I said, we got $100 million. We offered base grants of 20% just to cover the additional administrative costs associated with Davis-Bacon, Buy America, stuff like that. But as those projects went from getting all their plans and specs approved and permitting and things like that, we started doing a few in 09, but it was really fiscal year 10 where most of those funds were issued under contract and projects proceeded. Plus that carryover, we had a lot of communities looking at because of the very low cost of materials and the bids and very low interest rates. We had another influx of cities that had projects on the shelf that went forward. We expect that curve, 210, 211, to drop back down substantially as the economy is slowing, municipal appetite for issuing debt down quite a bit.
But,
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, as you mentioned, the other thing that's coming in there, because and this format that we had to use here is limiting because it includes the expenditures as both the disbursements that we make on the loans and grants, but it also has all of our
revenue.
Debt service, the regular debt service that we're paying on our bonds, as well as the refunding that Terry mentioned, that we the large refunding that we did in the fall of 2010. So all of that gets lumped together here, and that's the reason that 2010-11 bar goes up so high. We certainly can provide a breakout of the breaking out the bond debt service from the project disbursements, and that would be a much better way to do it. We were kind of limited by the way the software worked for this to create this chart, but we'd be happy to provide more information.
Well, Mr. Coleman, Mr. Freeman, that's why we sent a letter to try and get a clearer picture of a very complex budget that you oversee. There are so many different aspects of this, and what we need to figure out is we know that the bond market goes up and down and the activity goes up and down, but we need to see what the operational costs, what happens to those costs as we go through those different cycles. And so, Mr. Coleman, can you tell me the status of response to the letter we sent?
The letter was completed, and I signed off on it last week, and the governor's just in time for the governor's office to request all those letters and been told to hold on to it until further work. But it is all public information. I would be more than willing, if Joe has time, sit down, go through item by item. I'm a little hesitant to give you a letter with my name signed on it right now, with my boss telling me not to do so.
Well, thank you for your honest answer to that question, Mr. Coleman. And I think that's very disappointing to hear that you've, in effect, been given orders not to respond to our legitimate request for information to understand your operation. You folks do a great job. This is a very important activity and service that we provide in the state of Minnesota, and we have the responsibility to make sure that We understand all of the needs and the costs and what the trends are and so on. And so I'm very disappointed to hear that. One follow-up question I have as well is to what extent are we able to meet the need? Being a former local government official and close to local governments throughout the state, I certainly understand how important the ability to get financing for various projects is. To what extent are we able to meet the need in Minnesota? What kind of backlog are we looking at here?
Mr. Chair, on the drinking water program, we've opened it up wide open for several years now, and when we first started, we did as well. And then we started having raising the cutoff line. We probably will next year as well start raising it on the drinking water. Depending on the federal appropriations, it looks like they'll be cut back substantially. On the wastewater side, we've never been able to open it wide up, so it's always looking at the top higher priority projects. And on the priority list, that green sheet in here, you'll see our cutoff has been 45 points, usually between 40 and 45 points, depending on which projects are ready to go in any given year. The projects below that, to be quite honest, on a normal, we don't see a huge environmental need. The city's may want to proceed with projects for multiple reasons, either capacity issues or the system just aging and falling apart. If there are compliance issues that they have to deal with, they tend to rank higher in the fundable range if they're being forced to do anything by MPCA. It would take a lot of it would take the level of funding we've done in the last 2 years to try to address that backlog, but for the last 20-some years, we've always just tried to address the highest environmental priorities.
So. Thank you. Other questions from members? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, maybe we don't need to go down this rabbit hole, but I share your concern that we're not going to get the information that we need to make intelligent choices about budgets and where there are reasonable places for reductions. And so I don't know if I could, Mr. Chair, who is your boss that told you not to respond to the legislature's request for that information?
Mr. Coleman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downing, it was an email forwarded to me by the fiscal person at Deed, because my chair, who's the commissioner of Deed, wanted to see the report before it went. I sent it to him. Signed, ready to ship over here, and I was forwarded an email, and right offhand, I can't tell you the exact person. I think it might have been Commissioner Showalter that asked agencies to hold off until the governor's response, but I can double-check on that email. I treat this stuff as all the questions you ask, Mr. Chair, as public information. It's there, it's readily available. It's not easy to figure out on the system because the explanations and footnotes aren't there. I'll do my best to give that information to the committee as fast as possible. If not, like I said, I'm more than willing to sit down with Joe and go through BBS and explain it, because that's basically everything is in the system. It's a matter of understanding it because it is very confusing, and I do not understand it without assistance from my finance person. So with that, I'll do my best.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make a comment, and I'm, it's eminently frustrating that we're sitting here with this challenge, waiting 6 weeks for the governor's budget. It comes out, and I'm struggling to find a single area of redesign and reform and a detailed look down into these agency functions that gives us any chance at making substantive changes, real changes to the way we do things that might actually improve what we do, provide a higher level of service, root out the costs. And, you know, I've always said this is really hard work. When you want to pick apart a big budget and a big agency and go down into their functions and try and find the places where you can make improvements and find savings, Representative Banyan's bill, you know, says we should do just that. Now, not only is the administration not doing that, but they're going to somehow block us doing that. What a statement, that our only solution is to just ask taxpayers to continue to write bigger checks and not do any of the hard work to get down into the details of what we're doing. That's a really sad statement, and so I guess it's left to us. The committees of the legislature and the people in our positions are going to have to do this hard work over the obstacles of the executive branch. That's really a disappointing statement.
Representative Benson, and then we need to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm as frustrated as is the tone of the tenor of the conversation we've just had. I'm wondering, as a suggestion, that we might ask Commissioner Showalter to present himself at the committee and explain his decision not to make the information available, if that's who indeed has kept the information from coming to the committee.
Reasonable request. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downing, I know this is the first time you've ever seen a budget from a newly elected governor. I've actually gone through several of them, and I would challenge you to go look at any other budget presented by any newly elected governor, going down to Pawlenty, going down to Perpich, even our most exotic newly elected governor, Ventura, that managed to come out with dramatic changes and dramatic positions for reform in their budget message. These typically things that people want to do typically come out over the session, come out perhaps in the next session, and so forth. It is a challenge to take this budget and deal with it when, particularly in this case, when you had a governor who had to wait for a totally unnecessary recount decision to come through. So I would just show a little patience, and I agree with you that we need to do things through legislative initiatives, and if we also agree that we need to do them through reasonable compromise of positions, maybe we'll get some things done.
We need to move on if we can. And thank you very much, Mr. Coleman and Mr. Freeman, thank you for your straightforward responses to our questions, and appreciate you being here today. Thank you. We're next going to turn to Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Radzak from Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you for the opportunity to have me here today. My colleague, who's usually with me, he just had a, him and his wife just had a baby girl, so that's why I'm alone. So it's exciting times. In the packet, I think you see the overview from Minnesota Public Radio. I'll just begin on the first page that lists our mission and our vision and our strategy. We have, in Minnesota Public Radio employs 462 people. We are an organization that is dedicated to Minnesota and to serving Minnesotans, both in greater Minnesota and in the metro areas. And we are proud of the fact that we reach 95% of the population through our broadcast signal. On the next page, you see the pictures depicting 40 years of our history. Those are some snapshots. We were founded in 1967 in Collegeville, and we enjoy a rich history of serving Minnesotans. We are, as many of you know, we are a national model for the successes of public broadcasting and the reach that we have had within the state and nationally. We have three services that are available to Minnesotans: NPR News, Classical Minnesota Public Radio, and 89.3 The Current, which is our alternative music radio station that focuses on local artists. The Current is available in Rochester, Mankato, Hinckley, Austin, and now New Ulm, And I don't know if you all share this sentiment, but the one question that I get pretty much all the time is, when is the current going to come to blank town? So we recognize that that is an interest of many of your constituents, and we're always hoping that a broadcast signal will become available from the FCC. On the next page, you see a map of Minnesota with the signals that are available throughout the state. Many of you have probably heard them on your drive to and from the cities, at least at one time or another. Our web presence is growing with the recognition that more and more people are relying on the internet. And over each month, we have nearly 900,000 visitors to our webpage. We have a lot of our content archived and available for folks who weren't able to listen. We have podcasts available and other services. Our news, Minnesota Public Radio News, has the region's largest broadcast news staff, over 70 journalists, producers, editors, and hosts. We've won many awards, and we pride ourselves on doing our best to be objective and fact-based. Our next slide shows the classical Minnesota Public Radio webpage. We have a great group of folks who are very interested in trying to reach out to more Minnesotans with our classical music service, understanding that it's something that, with a little education, should be accessible to everybody. It's there's long-standing recognition that there's a barrier for many of us to kind of enjoy classical in the way that we hope to make it available to all Minnesotans. And we are the large Minnesota Public Radio is the largest producer of classical music programming in the country. The current, the alternative music radio station with a focus on Minnesota artists, is 6 years old. They just had its sixth birthday party. And this, besides providing a platform for many local artists and bands, it also, I think, does a really good job of reaching out to the community with programs like Rock the Cradle for young Minnesotans to be introduced to music and band, and also Rock the Garden, a family event every summer that we partner with the Walker Art Center, and it grows every year. After the pictures of the cute kids, the cute kid with the trumpet, there's a slide here, NPR as the backbone to the regional, as the backbone to the emergency alert system and the Amber Alert system. So now I'm getting to the part where we're talking about our general fund dollars. The Amber Alert system, we're the backbone because of our unique position, having a broadcast signal available to 95% of the state. We receive emergency signals from a handful of different places, from the FEMA or the state of Minnesota, the Department of Public Safety with regard to the Amber Alert signal. And we distribute that signal then to all broadcasters in the state, television and radio and cable providers are monitoring our signal. And that way, because we are available immediately, people get the signal as quickly as possible. With our general fund request, we are respectfully requesting $460,000 for the FY 12 and 13 biennium. And this request is broken down into two parts. The first is for an upgrade to that emergency and Amber Alert system I just mentioned. The FCC is requiring that, for the first time, the all states' EAS systems are going to be tied to the internet, which will allow for more local access to the system. So now, instead of statewide or nothing, as it currently stands, it can be accessed both to send and receive signals on a local basis. But in order to do that, one thing we know is they're going to be requiring new encoder and decoder boxes at each of the sites. Additionally, we know that they're going to be requiring that all, not just broadcasters, but other local entities have receive the signal and then distribute it in, within their local audience. So, for example, besides just radio, television, it's going to be cell phone providers, internet providers, nursing homes, schools, folks like that. So that's where the $154,000 comes in. and the second part of it, the $306,000. On the next slide, you can see after the FCC mandate slide, we have infrastructure in places like Worthington, Bemidji, Brainerd, Buell, Rochester, St. Peter, Appleton, Moorhead, Grand Marais, Roseau, Thief River Falls, and Hinckley that needs repairs and upgrades. Some of it is more than 40 years old and is just simply on its last legs. In one example, I know a transmitter kind of got beat. I think that was in Worthington, got beat up by the snowstorm. And those are some examples of what the current need is for equipment. Our need, our engineers ran an estimate of all the details for each of those requests, and it greatly exceeds the $306,000 range, but in an interest of being respectful of the position you all are in, a larger amount for a request would, I don't think, be appropriate. So that's where we are. That's our general fund request, and with that, Mr. Chair and members, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Radzak. The $460,000 request, I'm looking at the public broadcasting summary on the governor's budget, and it shows the general fund current appropriation for the next biennium at 1.866 million for each of the 2 years, total of 3.7. I assume the 460 is a part of that number, and is there any other portion of that overall public broadcasting that appropriation that would go to public radio?
Mr. Chair, members, if I know that the Association of Minnesota's Educational and Public Radio Stations, AMPRS, who is testifying today, that also would be public radio, and their appropriation would be in there for general fund, and also public television would also be in there. And I think those are the three that are lumped together in his recommendation. Did that answer your question?
Could you give us a breakdown of that total appropriation, how much goes to Minnesota Public Radio requests?
Mr. Chair, members, the governor is recommending 438, $238 for each year of the biennium, and I think it comes in at, when you look at the large spreadsheet, the breakdown is $238 and $238 for a total of $476 for the biennium, which is more than what our request is before you today.
Yes, Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, members, you do have a spreadsheet in your package that looks like this, that is the breakdown of all of the governor's recommendations for the committee. And if you look on page 11, you'll see the breakdown of the public broadcasting requests. These are grants that flow through the Department of Administration. And under public radio, you can see the NPR base is what the governor had recommended, which is actually $476,000, which is greater than what NPR is requesting. And you'll also see the AMPRS breakdown of $556,000 for the biennium for community service grants, and then $194,000 for equipment grants. And I should also note that I am able to, if you're looking at some of these budget pages and they don't provide enough detail, I can run additional detail out of the budget system. So if you require that, just let me know, and I can do that for you.
Thank you. Questions from committee? Representative Stenzerer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, like a total number of employees that are in your organization. And I'd be curious, like over the last maybe 10 years, is that, are you bigger today than you were 10 years ago?
Ms. Radzak?
Chair Lanning, Representative, yes, we are bigger. By a percentage, I'm not exactly sure. I'd be happy to find out for you. Within Minnesota Public Radio, we have 476, let me just really make sure I'm using the right number. 462, I'm sorry. 462 employees within Minnesota Public Radio.
Okay. Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Radzik. Of course, I listen to NPR, so I'm somewhat of a fan, and I appreciate the good news. But I am still trying to understand the budget. And one thing is, you're running those ads right now about the Congress, the House of Representatives cut the budget. So there's federal funding, and obviously there's state funding. And what of your total budget? How much of it is federal funding versus state? And what does happen if a cut like that is made? Is there just less programming, or you go to national programming, or you? What's the backup plan?
Ms. Radzik?
Chair Lanning, Representative Slawick. I have a breakdown of our budget by percentage, and I don't know if the chair would like this passed out or not, but I can tell you and because of rounding on here, it says federal government is 6%, or I'm sorry, 5%. So it's a little more than 5% federal and a little less than 2% state. That's our general fund and our legacy appropriation. So our total is just around 8% of our revenue is government funding. With regard to what would happen if the current House proposal in the Congress were to become law, what is on the table, what the House passed, is total elimination of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's funding. And that means about $4 million and some change for Minnesota Public Radio. We are in the process of figuring out exactly what that would mean for us, but we know it would be a significant number of employees as well as some changes to our programming. The difficulty in discerning how that would play out is because it is a distribution system with our programming, and we create and produce and distribute programming. And so part of it would be deciding what if some stations were knocked off completely around the country, how would that change our revenue from the programs we distribute? And so some of it is unknown, but like I said, they're running some scenarios and trying to figure out exactly what that mean if that became law.
Representative Leidiger.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to see that handout. I think that's going to answer my question. I'm looking at... I'd like to know the overall budget that you operate with. That should answer the question, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Radzik?
I don't, Mr. Chair, Representative Leidinger, I don't know if that's going to have the total budget there for you. Mr. Chair, the letter that we provided to the committee in response to your request had, I think, the answer, and I'm sorry that I don't have enough copies for everybody. I don't have enough copies for anyone on the committee, but I have a handout here that says our total operating budget, and our in there you can see how the state of Minnesota and the general fund and the legacy break out within that budget. I don't know if I'd be happy to make sure that you guys have additional copies. Like I said, it's the last page of the memo that we provided to you on Friday.
If any members would like to have a copy of that, we can supply that. We appreciate their responding to our request. Representative Leidiger, does this address your question, or do you have a further question?
Well, the other handout probably has the information. This handout shows where all the support comes from. What are the total dollars that you operate with on an annual basis?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Leidinger, our net operating budget for fiscal year 2010 was, I'm looking at the number here. I'm sorry, for fiscal year 11, our total operating budget was around $78 million for fiscal year 11.
And
Representative Leidiger?
Thank you. So the total amount that public radio is asking from the state is the $460,000? Or is there some additional money that comes from... We have purview over the legacy fund, too, right? I mean, is this funding come out of the legacy fund usually? I'm asking.
Well, Representative Leidiger, our committee does not deal with the legacy funds.
So it's
Representative Erdahl's committee deals with that, and then the Environment Finance, Representative Erdahl's committee reports to Environment Finance. Specifically, Ms. Roberts pointed out that the request, the total request from Minnesota Public Radio for the next biennium is $1,226,000, if I understand correctly. Is that correct, Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, the $1,226,000 is the total for both NPR and Rutgers.
Okay.
The total general fund, the governor has recommended the base funding, which was $476,000. NPR is saying they would like $460,000. That's only the general fund portion of the request. I'm sure they would have, and I don't know, but I'm guessing they have a request before from Senator Dahl's committee for it.
And that's, Mr. Chairman, and that's what I would like to know what that figure is as well, please.
Okay. Maybe Representative Erdahl can address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Leiniger, Ms. Radzik, you may actually have the legacy request. I, off the top of my head, don't remember what that is. Just come to you in a second. But Chair Lanning is correct that what we're seeing before us today is general fund. Has nothing to do with the legacy money. And in terms of, you know, if legacy funding were to be used for this, then we're getting into the supplementing versus supplanting area. Legacy funding is only supposed to supplement, do more of something, not take the place of other dollars that are in the general fund now. But those definitions continue to be debated. Ms. Radzik, do you have the legacy total, your request there?
Ms. Radzik?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Our last in 10 and 11, our appropriation from the legacy amendment was $2.65 million. Our request for 12 and 13 is $3.3
million. Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, sir. I just want to make sure I get these numbers correct. You're a $78 million organization per year?
Correct.
You're requesting $1.65 million per year from the legacy fund, and then the $230,000 from the general fund per year. That's what I want to do is understand that picture. But my question. My follow-up question is, you're running funding drives all the time, if I'm not mistaken. And how much does of the revenue comes from the general public during these fund drives that you do?
Ms. Radzik?
Chair Lanning, Representative Leiniger, the member drives, member support is our largest source of funds. The specifically of the, let's see, my dollar amount is right here. It's about 18% of the money that does not come from the first pie chart there, I guess, the government. Or from broadcasting activities, it's about about $8 million from membership that we take in annually.
Okay. $8 million. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Lilly. Okay. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Radzik. I had in the letter sent, I was calculating over 10 years, it appears to me that you had about a 38-39% growth in a total number of employees over a 10-year period. And I'm just curious how private radio stations might compare in terms of the market. Is the market growing in terms of profit or success and a number of employees, would we see a comparable growth in the private radio?
Ms. Radzik?
Chair Lanning, Representative Stensrud, I just have to be honest, I don't know. I'd be happy to do what I could to find out some information for you about that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Radzik, NPR covers about 95% of the state of Minnesota, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct, yes.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, so comparing NPR to a private radio station is like comparing apples to elephants. I mean, that those are run by the Federal Communication Administration. They're very narrow in their scope. They don't cover the state. Is that correct? Like
Ms. Reisig?
KSTP or whatever.
Ms. Reisig?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is tricky to compare them because they do serve different purposes, yes.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative
Gauthier, Ms. Radzik, you are in fact requesting $16,000 less than in the government's governor's budget, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
And one further question, Mr. Chairman, would you consider NPR with the number of employees? Would you consider it a lean agency, as far as work production and getting the most for your dollar?
Ms. Radzik?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would, and in particular with regard to the state funds, I'm always working with the general funds in particular, working with our engineers and our staff to stretch those dollars as far as possible to make sure that we're only coming to you with very real needs and not wants, yes.
And Mr. Chair, just a comment.
I've got here.
It is my opinion that NPR is probably the most unbiased and most objective news source that the state has. And I get a little concerned when we start looking at making cuts to information that not only public officials need, but the public need to make good decisions. And so I want to commend NPR for their work and their dedication through all these years of providing objective news reporting. And I'm a big fan, so I'm going to support your request, Tom. And I'd like to just thank you for appearing today.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
We're not going to debate the news or rate the news sources here in this discussion.
No, we will eventually, Chairman.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify. I was looking through a couple documents trying to determine. It appears as though you're the CEO of your organization makes over $370,000 a year. Can you kind of confirm that? And it's my understanding he also has pay that comes from other corporations, or that's just one source of a paycheck for him. Is that an accurate understanding from my perspective?
Ms. Radzik?
Chair Lanning, Representative Stensrud, I have a copy of the 990 that we file with the IRS every 2 years, I believe. And I know this information is also available on the Attorney General's website. Our CEO, Mr. Kling, his total compensation is $654,338. And I can show you how that's broken down if the chair would like us to hand these out.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, we will move on to the next. Thank you, Ms. Radzik, for being here today and for your response to our request.
Thank you, Chair Lanning.
Members, we have to do our minutes before we finish up here. Would someone move the minutes from the 17th?
Sure. I shall move.
Moved by Gunther. Any additions or corrections to the minutes of February 17th? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Next, we have Minnesota Public Television. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Strasinski, representing the Minnesota Public Television Association. And, Mr. Chair, my name is Alan Harmon. I'm general manager of WDSE-WRPT, the public television station which serves Duluth and Hibbing, and also currently serve as president of the MPTA, or Minnesota Public Television Association.
Welcome. Thank you, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to note in your packages today there are two different handouts that deal with some of the issues we'll be discussing today. Basically, the first handout looks like this. It's a form. I won't take you through all the details, but it's our attempt to give you some history, tell you about the six public television stations, our values, our community values, our what we've done with some legacy funds, what we've done with how the taxpayers' return on investment works, what have you. And the other document we'll be discussing is this investment comparison between states and what happens here in Minnesota on a per capita basis. But thank you for your past support. We have a very unique program in state government as it relates to public television, but a little bit of the history is probably important and to tell you really who we are, what public television really is in Minnesota. Public television frequencies were reserved by the federal government in the 1940s as the demand for commercial television licenses exploded. Congress specifically charged these public television stations with the responsibility to forever preserve an opportunity for all citizens to have access to non-commercial media in order to provide for a free exchange of information and ideas, and they believe that to be essential to our democracy. Today, public television in Minnesota is the legislature's access to the public. Public television's free to the viewer over-the-air service serves as a complement to government transparency. Citizens should not have to buy high-speed internet service from some internet provider just to watch see their legislators in action. In a digital environment, which happened in the past 5 years, our ability to bring more programming to the public has greatly expanded. This digital environment has enabled us to partner with many nonprofit, community-based organizations so as to bring their message to a much larger audience. One of the new channels is exclusively used as a safe haven, children's education channel. Another channel is the Minnesota channel, which focuses on making state government more transparent and accessible to the public. For example, we provide gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Minnesota legislature, including all floor sessions and several committee hearings. Our channels will be used to continue to educate the public on important issues ranging from how to deal with the stress of losing your job in this economy to helping Minnesota National Guard families that have a member deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, or Bosnia. We did this program, by the way, in concert with the Red Bull Division. And, of course, we will continue to provide the great cultural and public affairs programming that you have come to appreciate. Public television is viewed as a cradle-to-grave educator and a provider of quality programming and interactive services for all of the public. Mr. Chairman, I want to share a few facts with you about public television. Public television is a trusted source of nonviolent, non-explicit educational and cultural affairs and public affairs programming. We reach over 4.6 million residents over the air. They just simply have to turn on their television set, provided they have a digital converter box nowadays. And we reach all Minnesotans on cable and on satellite. We provide programs, and our programs are viewed by each and every one of your constituents. Each station is community-owned and operated. Each station develops local programs important to their viewers. And public television provides educational services to over 275 school districts and approaching 200,000 students. All state grants are matched from a variety of sources, and we do not get the state match. It's identified in this program here in 129D until we raise money locally to match the state dollars that are available to us. Public television serves more people more often than any other cultural and educational institution in Minnesota. In fact, over 2 million people a week watch public television. The governor did recommend $1,303,000 per year, or $2.606 for the biennium. The matching grant process are references identified in Minnesota Statutes 129D. And needless to say, Mr. Chairman, we do support the governor's recommendation. Now, we've experienced grant reductions for a decade. In fact, our last year's grant was one half of the grants that they were 10 years ago. All stations in the digital age have reinvented themselves. We've laid off staff where appropriate. We've become more efficient, and we collaborate with each other on an unprecedented scale. Further erosion of our base government partnership support will have a direct impact on our ability to help you to be true to your mission and to make your keep your actions transparent to the public. These operational grants, as I said, are extremely important. They're essential to station operations, and they provide for some of the fundamental things like lights, heat, to help pay for some of the staff. All contributions generated from respective communities, again, are matched with state funds, federal funds, and foundation funds. From a business perspective, the dividends generated by your investment include free non-commercial television for all, free on-demand programs online, free educational material for schools and teachers, free children's programs, and free public safety emergency communications, just to name a few. Now, to increase efficiency of the state's investment in public television, grants received by each station are matched from other sources, as I referenced. Your investment in money into Minnesota brings money into Minnesota that otherwise would go to some other state. In fact, last year, the state operating support of about $1,258,000 in our grants generated almost $6 million alone in a federal match. That money came into Minnesota that would have gone elsewhere. The correct way to view the state's investment is $1 generates a range from $5 to $14 in revenue from non-state sources. I would say that's an excellent return on your investment. For a few closing thoughts, I'd like to say that public television is you. In fact, it's all of us. Our mission is basically the same as yours. All of us want to have an informed public and develop good citizens. We continue to pledge to use state dollars wisely, and continue to take current events, cultural events, and programs about our environment, our history, and our heritage to a statewide audience. State government has a long history of working with business and public corporations like public television. You have provided, and I suspect you will continue to provide, incentives to the business community and the nonprofit community, which will enable them to create non-governmental jobs and services and deliver those services. Your investment in our public television organizations is modest, but it is essential. Finally, as you make your decisions, please remember that public television cannot meet their financial obligations alone, even though our stations are masters at fundraising. While the digital age is very expensive, the opportunities are enormous. And you should know, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that we are neither competitors nor a threat to commercial broadcasters. Commercial broadcasters are our friends, because we're their public television station, too. And we do things that they are not structured to or can afford to do, due to advertising revenues, that sort of thing. But we continue to need your support to help meet these challenges. Mr. Chairman, we've always been willing to be held accountable for our products and our services, and we will continue to provide measurable, transparent objectives. We can and do guarantee a very large return for each dollar you invest in us. Thank you, Mr. Harmon.
Thank you, Mr. Harmon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to provide just a little bit of supplement to what Mr. Brzezinski has said to help you understand a little more about how public television in Minnesota works. I'm here in two roles, first as the general manager of one of the six independent local organizations that provide public television service to the state. Each of those organizations, headquartered in Appleton, Austin, Bemidji, Duluth, Moorhead Fargo, St. Paul, is accountable to its own community, both because we are governed by a board of local volunteers, but also we're subject to the discipline of the market. We, as you are well aware, go before the public and invite them to pay for something that they don't have to pay for, that's available for free. we would only enjoy citizen support if citizens saw value in that service. I'm also here as president of the MPTA. MPTA is a single organization. It's really unique in the nation. As a voluntary organization of the public television station serving the state, committed to efficiency and effectiveness in how we provide services statewide. We partner with the state to provide not only live broadcast of the legislative session, but also programs originated locally in response to local needs, such as the Your Legislators program that I'm sure many of you have appeared on, and in Northern Minnesota, Minnesota Legislative Report, which will be beginning its 40th year in the next several weeks. As Mr. Szczesinski mentioned, we've also cooperated with DEED, with the DNR, with other state agencies to be sure that information that is needed statewide is made available statewide. What we do with the operating dollars that legislative support provides is to maintain and make available to Minnesotans the nation's biggest stage, its biggest classroom, its biggest archive of documentary materials, and make that available to over 95% of citizens. When we ask whether we're doing a good job, the response is overwhelmingly positive. National polls have shown that public television is considered the most trusted of media outlets, that it is the second best use of tax dollars, second only to national defense, and that 85% of Americans believe that the money that goes to public television is well spent. Our coverage, our service includes legislative coverage. It complements and does not compete with commercial offerings. An anecdotal example of that. A viewer in Grand Rapids was frankly incensed by the, if you take the all caps use in the email that she sent to all the Duluth broadcasters, us included, about why she could not watch the governor's State of the State address on television. Each of the three Duluth commercial broadcasters responded, well, public television is doing that. And in fact, we did, and we contacted her and told her, you can watch it right now by turning on your television. From a management perspective, public television has been under a fair amount of economic duress for some time. As Mr. Szczesinski already noted, our state appropriations are less now than what they were 10 years ago. Those cuts took place before the economic downturn. We have certainly seen reductions in other funding sources as a result of the economic downturn that have forced us to reinvent, to rethink, to redesign the ways in which we do business. Frankly, from a management perspective, any low-hanging fruit at this point is gone. Further reductions, as in response to the committee's questions, frankly mean a reduction in jobs, a loss of the skills, the talents that we need in order to continue to provide the service that we have provided the state for over 40 years. Those specific responses will vary from station to station because, again, each station is independently managed and operated to serve its local community. Those cuts would include cuts in services to schools in Fargo and Duluth, where those stations have continued to provide those services. Other stations have already eliminated those services. In Lakeland, public television, the station that serves Bemidji and Brainerd, it would mean reductions in their news coverage, the only locally originated television news in that part of the state. Pioneer and Appleton would be forced to eliminate the Your Legislators program, which for them is particularly labor-intensive, and their production of Prairie Sportsman. And here in the St. Paul, TPT would have to reduce their support of Almanac and Almanac at the Capitol, having the unfortunate unintended consequence of limiting the availability of information to citizens. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think that sums up our presentation. We'd be more than willing to take any questions.
Questions from the members. We can just take a couple minutes, and then we need to move to the last presenters. Any questions? Representative Benson.
Just maybe a couple of comments. First of all, in your handout, it's got taxpayers' return on investment. I look at that and I say to myself, if that's a return on investment, it's taxpayers and taxpayers, because I'm looking at one-year state funding of $1,258,000 with a federal match. I'm guessing that you probably understand that it's still the taxpayers' money that's coming back. So, I don't, you know, if you were making money with it from the private sector, it'd be one thing. But since we're just paying out of tax anyway. The second is, you know, as sensitive I am to the economic downturn and that how that has played into any nonprofit's ability to raise funds. I teach a nonprofit class and in a business program, and I get all the publications that chronicle those things. But you're not doing too bad, because I'm looking at the legacy funding and I'm seeing that 37 jobs were created, and I'm assuming that that's only since the legacy fund began putting money into your agency's coffers. So I'm sensitive on one hand that nonprofits are having a difficult time, but on the other I'm seeing that you're creating. And those are FTE positions that are ongoing FTE because of legacy funds?
Representative Benson, Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, those are, first of all, we have been very, very careful in accounting for the supplement, not supplant, provision of the legacy funds. Those 37 full-time equivalents are jobs created using legacy funds, independent of what was going on elsewhere in the organization.
Okay.
Representative Benson?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm starting to get used to that, the whole idea of supplanting. That is, in my case, at least when I'm thinking about it, some cover also for growth. But nevertheless, I thank you for your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to add one thing there that's important. The 37 jobs created, all the legacy fund goes basically, as Representative Erdahl and others will tell you, that it goes into production. Okay, it's not into maintaining station operations, those kinds of things, or doing other kinds of programs. They're specifically dedicated. We file specific reports on a quarterly basis to the state of Minnesota. We have a contractual relationship. One of the objectives of the legacy dollars last year was job creation. So we've added this much to our base, but strictly with legacy dollars to do. And we've got quite an extensive report on that, but I thought some of the summaries were there. I really admire your question about taxpayer dollars. In this world that I deal with here, dealing with the Minnesota State Legislature, I don't deal with Congress. We all are taxpayers. That I readily admit and understand. But those taxpayer dollar decisions at the federal level, those dollars are available and they're going to go somewhere. So Minnesota citizens can bring some of that revenue back into Minnesota out of that other pocket, if you will, instead of going somewhere else. We think that's a good return. And let me just also suggest that we generate $5 to $14 for every state dollar we get in our matching grants program. And the way to look at this stuff is that if we were cut, this is true, if we were be cut by $250,000, 15 to 20% of our request, that translates to about $250,000, roughly, which would translate to a loss of on the federal side alone, about $1,250,000, and dollars from other sources, because a lot of our stuff is matched from a variety of areas. So I just wanted to put it in that perspective for you. I mean, we're pretty lean. Our employee number base, I just checked this morning, is less than what it was 10 years ago, except for the legacy side, which is strictly production. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just one more
Benson.
Follow-up. Thank you, sir. Just from the way we are hearing things coming out of Washington, D.C., any concern that ratio may change? Because you're looking at dollars, and you know, if that's a big part of how you operate, are you concerned about how that ratio may change?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Benson, yes, clearly we are. as the representative from Minnesota Public Radio mentioned earlier, we don't know what all the repercussions of those changes will be, and so at this point we are working on how we manage our independent stations to survive without that significant federal funding.
Mr. Chairman, and to be true to our mission as mandated, our envisioned by Congress in the 1940s about being your channel access to government decision making. Thank you.
Representative Anderson, a quick question, and then we have to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Straczynski or Mr. Harmon, I see the matching dollars here, federal and state. How much money do you raise privately from your fundraising? I think you just said it was a $5 or $14 for every dollar, but maybe I was mistaken on that.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Straczynski.
Do I have that number? I don't think I have specifically by viewers. I've got our total cost of all of our budgets for public television for all the six stations serving Minnesota is about $29,700,000. That's basically what our operating budgets are for all the six stations providing 100% service to everybody. So, and I don't know how much, Mr. Anderson, how much of that comes from viewers. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I can speak for Duluth. Those are the numbers I carry around on the top of my head. Roughly a third of our budget comes from local individual member support. Another 10% comes from small businesses that support us through underwriting. So about 40% directly out of the community.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Harmon, is that per year, or is that on a biennium type basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is on, I guess, on a percentage basis. It doesn't matter whether it's annual or biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Harmon, $29,700,000, is that per year? Is that the amount per year?
I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is annual budget for total of the six stations serving Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harmon, Mr. Straczynski, and appreciate your being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We will now move to our last presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, AMPRS. AMPRS is an association of 12 different independent stations, 11 of which qualify for state funding that comes that is administered by the Department of Administration. Couple things I wanted to point out. You have in your packet a handout. It says AMPRS on it. And our president, Michelle Jansen, will walk you through that. I just had a couple of comments before she begins, and then I will be here to help answer questions if there are any. One of the things that AMPRS does, AMPRS stations do as a recipient of state grants, is we treat those like underwriting credits. We acknowledge the participation by the state with our on-air acknowledgments. It gives our listeners a feeling that they are getting something back from the state taxes they have contributed, but they also dig into their own pockets. Most of our stations are members of the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. This is primarily the commercial broadcasters. We've received a fair amount of support over the years from them. They do not see us as competitors, but rather as contributors to their livelihood, because those of our stations that train students, those students end up working in primarily commercial broadcasting, and we're part of the training ground of that. And finally, we are also recipients of legacy funds from 2 years ago. It's the same amount of money as the Minnesota Public Radio received, and we, as the other public broadcasters, use those monies to expand our programming, not to replace what we're doing already. I will now pass the testimony over to Michelle Jansen, the AMPRS president from KBEM FM Jazz 88 in Minneapolis.
Welcome, Ms. Jansen. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chairman Lanning, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Jansen. I am the president of AMPERS, and I'm also station manager for Jazz 88 KBEM here in the Twin Cities. I'd like to begin by thanking you for allowing us to be here today, and more importantly, I'd like to thank you for the funding which has allowed us to better serve the citizens of Minnesota. AMPERS, which provides diverse radio for Minnesota communities, is made up of 12 independently based community radio stations around Minnesota. We are not affiliated with, nor do we receive any funding from Minnesota Public Radio. Each AMPERS station is licensed to a college, school, a university, or it's licensed directly to the community it serves. The AMPERS stations include WTIP-FM, serving Grand Marais, Grand Portage, and the Gunflint Trail, and is licensed directly to the community. KAXE serves the Grand Rapids, Bemidji, and Brainerd area, and is also community licensed. KSRQ in Thief River Falls is licensed to Northland Community and Technical College. KUMD covers the Duluth area and is affiliated with the University of Minnesota Duluth. KVSC-FM's broadcast signal covers the greater St. Cloud area and is licensed to St. Cloud State University. The four stations here in the Twin Cities include Jazz 88, my station, licensed to the Minneapolis Public Schools, KUOM Radio K at the University of Minnesota, and KFAI and KMOJ, which are both community licensed stations. In southern Minnesota, we have KMSU covering Mankato and Austin from Minnesota State University, Mankato, and KQAL at Winona State University. KUMM in Morris is licensed to the University of Minnesota Morris, but does not receive state funding because of its size. Because Minnesota Public Radio and the AMPERS stations are all public radio stations, understandably, there's a fair amount of confusion. The two serve very different audiences, very different needs, and operate in very different ways. The AMPERS stations are smaller community stations. Each station only has between 2 to 14 employees on staff, with many of them relying heavily on volunteers. The AMPERS stations are not rebroadcasting or retransmitting programming from one main station. Each station is individually programmed to meet the needs of their community. The stations all have their own local management and board of directors to ensure they are truly serving the needs of their local community on a grassroots level. As a result, we have programs in 13 different languages, ranging from Ojibwe to Oromo, as well as local public affairs programming and diverse music. Each station also has significant educational programs ranging from formal broadcast classes to hands-on training for community volunteers. In your packet of information, you'll find background about AMPERS, information about how the stations use state funding, as well as letters of support. AMPERS stations exist to serve their communities. That includes providing timely and accurate reports of local and state events, from severe weather and other emergencies to concerts, plays, and high school and college sporting events. Some stations even broadcast city council and school board meetings. AMPERS stations strive to identify areas not served by traditional media and fill those voids, like KAXE's recent decision to add a weekly program in Ojibwe. We work closely with local emergency officials like WTIP did when the huge Ham Lake fire ripped through northern Minnesota. WTIP was the only source of daily information about evacuations and other updates from the Forest Service, DNR officials, and the Sheriff's Department. And KVSC has a partnership with the Central Minnesota Audio Newspaper, where volunteers read daily and weekly newspapers to those unable to do so. We serve the underserved by providing programming for those not reached through traditional media, like programs in Hmong, in Somali, and Spanish, for example. KMSU in St. Cloud has 6 hours of Hispanic Latino programming every Saturday, and we promote civic engagement, media democracy, and equity. As part of our commitment to helping Minnesota, last year all of the AMPERS stations worked very closely with the U.S. Census, as well as the State Demographer's Office and Department of Administration, to try and make sure all Minnesotans were counted in the census. We put forth a special effort to reach new immigrants, English language learners, Native Americans, and others believed to be underrepresented in the 2000 census. AMPERS stations have received community service grants and equipment grants for more than 30 years, dating back to 1980. During that time, the Minnesota State Legislature has recognized the important role these stations serve as valuable resources for their communities. These grants provide us with the important funds to help us serve our local communities. In several areas, AMPR's stations provide the only option for emergency service agencies to get urgent and potentially life-saving information out to the public immediately. Please refer to page 13 of your handout, where you'll find a letter from the Cook County Sheriff. This letter talks about an incident last year when Northeast Minnesota lost basically all phone and internet service, and WTIP provided the only outlet for emergency information to the residents in the area. KVSC is the only station in St. Cloud that is staffed 20 of the 24 hours in a day. Having a live employee at the radio station rather than relying on automation means KVSC can get emergency information out to the community immediately, about 20 to 30 minutes faster than stations relying on automation.
Excuse me, Ms. Jansen, if you could please wrap up in just a minute or two so okay. We at least have a little time for questions.
Okay. We realize the severity of the budget crisis facing the state. We also realize that it's unfortunate it's going to be necessary for you to make cuts in order to balance the budget. Obviously, we'd prefer not to deal with budget cuts, especially as we face rising costs. In the event that you find it necessary to make cuts, we ask that you treat us as you would treat any other worthy recipient of the state's precious resources, ensuring that the cuts are reasonable and proportional to other agencies serving Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your continued support.
Thank you, Ms. Jansen. Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Jansen, you said the Morris station was because of its size that didn't get state. What do you mean?
Because
Ms. Jansen?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Murphy, because of the size of its signal. It's because of the size of the staffing at the station. The state law requires that there's at least two full-time employees at a radio station.
And or their equipment. Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, it's laid out in Minnesota Statutes 129D19. It spells all the criteria that have to be met to qualify for state grants, and one of them is you have to have two statewide or full-time employees or equivalent. You have to have a budget of $50,000 or more. You have to maintain programming.
It's too small.
Okay. It's a student-run operation. They do a great service for the student body, but it's a small station.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Tilley, Ms. Jansen, then does that area have some other station covering their emergency service then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, all stations in Minnesota have to have the emergency alert system of a part of their transmitter, and that allows the transmitter to be taken over by the emergency message. It automatically happens. Whether there's a person in the station or not, it's automatic. So as a condition of getting a federal license, you have to have that piece of equipment on your transmitter.
So Morris has it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard you say, I just wanted to clarify, I think you said that you receive legacy funding just as MPR receives or a similar amount. Is that correct? Could you clarify, what is that amount?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we received the same exact dollar amount as Minnesota Public Radio for each of the last 2 years of the biennium. And that first year, we received $1,150,000, and the second year, we received $1,500,000. And we were required to use those monies only on new programming, additions to what we were already doing. Like the other public broadcasters, we either hired a staff to produce this programming or we contracted with people from the community. And actually, we were 78 different people got new employment through the course of those grants. They won't be carried on beyond the grants if we don't get grants again. We've spent those monies back in the communities.
Representative Murphy, and then we will conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Just for clarification purposes, I would like to say that the legacy grants for, almost everything, but for all the public broadcasting legacy grants that were given 2009-10 were one-time appropriations. and almost all legacy grants for in every division that were given in 9 and 10 were one-time appropriations.
Thank you for that clarification. Mr. Tilley, Ms. Jansen, thank you for being here today. Appreciate that. And members, tomorrow we have the CAP Board and Department of Military Affairs. And then House File 384, Representative Detmer's bill. Meeting adjourned.